The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover books, we cover film, but this week on the podcast, we are going to cover TV, not just streaming TV, but all TV, because this week we have published our best and worst TV of 2024 lists. Separate articles, but very comprehensive, and I have enlisted three of our finest contributors to participate in those lists, and they're all joining me for the first time ever together as a team on the podcast this week. I have Matthew Ehrlich joining me from Brooklyn, New York. Hello, Matthew.
Hello.
From south of Austin, Texas. Not quite in Austin, Texas, but Austin-ish Texas. I have Omar Gayaga is here.
Hey, Neil. Howdy.
You live in, is that New Braunfels? You live in New Braunfels?
New Braunfels between Austin and San Antonio, a little German town.
New Braunfels, yeah, the home of the Schlitterbahn amusement park, as well as other things. It's not just an amusement park. Scott Gold does live in a town that is a big amusement park, New Orleans, Louisiana, and he is here as well. Hello, Scott.
Hey, y'all, what's up?
Yo, so you all contributed to our best and worst TV shows of the year, and what a variety of shows. You know, there were no double ups. I don't think there were any repeats. So we covered a lot of ground in those 4,000 or so words. I'm gonna not show any preferred child. I also was part of these lists, so I'm gonna talk as well. But I'm gonna just go alphabetical order, and we're gonna talk about the best shows of the year, and then we're gonna go with the worst. And so Omar, you are first in alphabetical order, and your list was. Your list was very interesting, and it was a lot of these shows that aren't shows that I was not super tuned into. You wrote about Fallout, which we've talked about on the show before. Mm-hmm. Also, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Shogun, John Mulaney's Everybody's in L.A., and Julio Torres's Fantasmas. So I wanted to talk about Fantasmas first and Julio Torres because he is a favorite of yours, and you've covered his life and work very well for us. So what is it about Fantasmas that qualified for you?
I almost gave Fantasmas a bad review based on the first episode or two. I didn't like it at first. I thought this is a misfire. This is not what I come to Julio Torres content for, you know, after having seen Problemista, which was fantastic, Los Spookies, which was great. The stuff he did on SNL was wonderful. And then, you know, this show, which was a weird, weird kind of sketch comedy show with all different kinds of tangents and characters. And it wasn't until maybe the second or third episode that I kind of got on its wavelength and thought, oh, that's what he's doing. He's doing the Julio Torres version of Saturday Night Live, like with you know, all of the associated weirdness that you would expect from Julio Torres. Once I kind of locked into that frequency, I ended up loving the rest of the episodes and then going back and watching the first two again and going, oh, okay, I get it.
It all pieced together. Torres is kind of like a Latino surrealist comedian, I would say.
He really is. And he's doing interesting stuff. And he has a very interesting visual aesthetic. And he's able to rope in people like Tilda Swinton and Paul Dano, and like all these amazing talents to kind of see his vision through and do these comedic bits. And I mean, the Paul Dano kind of ALF parody in that show is amazing. It's so good and funny.
There's a Paul Dano ALF. Does Paul Dano play ALF or does he play the dad?
He plays the dad who falls in love with the Alf, you know, the Alf character, gets a divorce and ends up living with the puppet. And it's devastating, but also very, very funny and weird. And Paul Dano plays it completely straight. So stuff like that, like, you know, just curveballs. And you know, I thought at this point we were done with Real Housewives parodies that had anything to say. And he actually manages to do one with Emma Stone that is, again, like just stunning in how well executed and funny it is. So yeah, he's mining really interesting stuff with really big stars who, you know, just have, he's just built this goodwill through Saturday Night Live and through the projects that he's done, that he can rope, you know, an Emma Stone or a Tilda Swinton to do these things with him. And they're great. So yeah, he's, Fantasmas kind of came out of nowhere. Like, we knew it was coming, and I think it was held back through the pandemic. But yeah, it's just one more notch in his belt. He's just sort of like, just hitting on every level with every project he releases. I can't wait to see what he does next. If there'll be another season of Fantasmas, or if he's going to do another movie. I'm not sure what he's got next, but I'm on board. He's earned my trust.
Julio Torres has earned Omar's trust. Omar is a guy who I consider him to be a person of good taste when it comes to comedy. So you also picked a John Mulaney project. You know, John Mulaney does not play it safe when it comes to what he decides to do on TV. You know, his stand-up,
or his life, apparently.
His life, yeah, for sure. You know, he is, you know, lives. Doesn't seem like someone who'd be living on the edge. He seems kind of normcore almost, and his stand-up isn't really that edgy. But you know, if you look at like that thing he did, the kids show parody, the Sack Lunch Bunch, which is something that I really liked a few years ago. Yeah, Everybody's in L.A. was a weird talk show.
It really was, and he, I don't think he plays it that safe. And I think the niceness is masking some real darkness and some real meanness that I think in the last comedy special he finally sort of let loose. So I think that's always been there. I think he's been very good at hiding it and kind of having this nice guy persona. But I think his last stand-up special, which was the Rehab special, and then this show, I think kind of has kind of given him more dimensions in as far as how we see him. And you know, he's not always nice. He's not always nice, even to the guests on his show. He wasn't always nice, or to the callers who called in. He was very impatient with people and would just hang up on them or move on, because he has a very strong vision of what he wanted this sort of late night live talk show to be. And it was all Mulaney. I mean, it felt like his comedy. It felt like everything.
Well, it wasn't all Mulaney. It wasn't all Mulaney. He did have Richard Kind playing his Ed McMahon.
Yes. Very smart choice.
The best Ed McMahon since Ed McMahon, for sure.
Absolutely. Very smart choice in that. And then just a weird eclectic group of guests that, you know, that every night were sort of mixing it up together, all on the couch. You know, he'd have six or seven people, which is usually a recipe for disaster on a talk show, but it was like he was courting that disaster. Like he was waiting for that stuff to fall apart and see what would happen then. So it was very experimental, very interesting. And he's lined up for another talk show with Netflix for next year that I don't know if it's going to take the same form or if it's going to be much different. But I mean, he sort of figured out a new way to do a talk show that no one's done before. That was a very ramshackle kind of improvised, you know, anything goes kind of format that I don't think we've seen in a really, really long time.
And I like that because I feel like talk shows have gotten very boring and staid, unpredictable, especially since Conan O'Brien went off the air. You know, they're just incredibly fossilized. So I enjoyed that show as well. It was really good to see it. So, all right, let's both you and Scott, we have to do a little Shogun discourse. Both you and Scott, you mentioned Shogun, which is, you know, pretty much every, as Scott said, it's on every critic's best of list, and it's usually at the top of every critic's best of list. This was like, Shogun was like an old-fashioned meat and potatoes epic Hollywood miniseries, essentially. And Scott, you feel free to chime in. You're now activated.
Yeah, it really did feel in a weird way like 1970s, 1980s, like premiere television, when you would actually wait for a whole week and then like gather around the TV and like find out was there something weirdly nostalgic about it, but they rebooted it in a way that was modern and paid homage to the original and, of course, the book in just the most fantastic way, and just made a television show that was, in every sense, premier television. The sets, the music, the performances were all brilliant, particularly the Japanese cast. You know, the pacing was great, the tension. I was just absolutely 100% transported to feudal Japan, and it was a really nice break from my day-to-day life, and that's what we, you know, look for in that kind of escapism.
You consider feudal Japan to be an escape from your mundane reality?
In a weird way, you know, it's definitely different from my, you know, day-to-day life, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's certainly more feudal.
It's definitely more feudal and way more violent. I'm happy that my life isn't that violent, but you know, it was just glorious to the point where it's just, you just could not wait for the next episode. And I just thought it was brilliant.
I liked it too, but I have to admit, I really, really, I love the Japanese actors. They were all just terrific. I will say I found Cosmo Jarvis in the Richard Chamberlain role to be less than stellar. So to me, I think that took away from it as far as I'm concerned. I know that he was sort of backgrounded by the end of the show. Maybe Omar and Scott can speak to that. Was your distaste for him not as strong as mine?
I mean, he's the viewpoint character, but he really didn't have to care. By the middle of the season, he really didn't have to carry the show anymore. Yeah. It was really about the other characters and sort of, his lens into it. But, he was certainly by the end of the show, it came back to him, but he was not, in my opinion, the main character of the show. He was just our entree into it.
I agree, but I just feel like, the old Dorothy Parker line, his emotions ran the gamut from A to B. Yeah. Really, really applied.
Yeah. I mean, he was kind of doing like a wish.com Tom Hardy kind of impersonation.
yeah.
But I thought he was fine, the gravelly voice, it was definitely a choice. But yeah, Omar was 100% right. It's all about the Japanese cast here, and they more than made up for his character, and his performance was fine, but the Japanese cast and the writing really just pulled me in. And the scenery, the sets, like just everything, I think, just the way they filmed it was just so beautiful and intriguing. And also there was a lot of really great tension and, just that little lens into what life was like then was just so fascinating and compelling to me.
Yeah. I mean, it was really a resonant of the golden age of miniseries, which I grew up watching, including the original Shogun. Maybe they'll remake Centennial, James A. Mitchner's Centennial. That was always my favorite. It was 26 hours long back when they did it.
For me, the big surprise in the show is Anna Sawai, because I saw her on the Godzilla show. What is it?
Monsters Inc. Godzilla Monsters Inc.
No, yeah. And she is not great in that show. And that show is not great.
Yeah. So. Godzilla Destroy All Monsters. Whatever, that it barely escaped worst shows of the year.
Monarch.
Yeah. All right. So, Scott, I wanted to get to your list. You mentioned The Gentleman and Shogun, and then Dune Prophecy, Dark Matter, X-Men 97, True Detective Night Country, and Agatha All Along. So it's a pretty eclectic list. Now, we talked on the show previously and fairly recently about Dune Prophecy and Agatha All Along, both of which I like. And we've also talked about X-Men 97, which I also like. So I want to sort of steer away from that, although, I could blather about Dune Prophecy for a while. But I wanted to talk about The Gentleman, which I thought was an interesting pick, because I saw that. I don't know. Did you see the movie, Scott?
I did, and I promptly forgot it.
Yeah.
Which is probably why I wasn't compelled to really watch this series. I waited on it for a long time.
Yeah.
Until a friend of mine whose opinion I trust said, hey, man, you got to check this out. And I was like, all right, fine. And I started watching it. And from that first episode, I was like, oh, okay, this is like prime level Guy Ritchie, like in his element, doing his thing. And it's awesome.
Yeah, because I kind of thought the movie The Gentleman was okay. But it was, I don't love Guy Ritchie, and I felt like the movie was kind of snarky nonsense. But my son, actually, who's my 22-year-old son, whose opinions I don't trust about anything except for TV, he does have pretty good taste in TV, he watched the whole thing in like 3 days. He was really into it. I have to admit, like I tuned in and I'm like, yeah, you know what? This has got it had some grit. It had some humor. It was fun. Gentleman was fun. And Theo James is just a big star, right?
Oh yeah. He absolutely, I remembered him from, was it the Divergent series? And I can't remember really seeing him in a whole lot else. So I didn't know.
Oh, he was in the White Lotus, season two of the White Lotus.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he was really great in the White Lotus. Thank you for reminding me of that. As a heel, he was completely despicable.
Yes.
Very different character here. Really, he gets to use his natural British accent, which I enjoy when actors get to do that. He also had a very good American accent, which was good. But seeing him like as, this English Duke, like you believe it, like you totally believe it. And it was really interesting to see, when we're used to, these period dramas about, royals and high class British society. But we don't get a lot of the modern take on what those families and what that lifestyle is like. And that was one of the things that was really interesting about this, that, we see kind of the high end and what, kind of the idle rich royals are up to. But at the same time, though, beneath everything, they're all completely corrupt and they're despicable and disgusting for the most part. They have awful habits. And of course, they get involved in this marijuana ring, which competes with other drug rings. And so the cast of characters is really diverse and really fascinating and all the different kind of crime circles and everything. My biggest problem with the show is that it had, you know, Giancarlo Esposito barely in it. Like, we barely get to see his character. I'm assuming he's going to have more of a part to play in the second season, but
he's contractually obligated to appear in every TV show
that features a drug lord. Yes.
Well, he was in The Boys also. And Omar, one of his worst shows, he was in I think Parish, it's called. He's also a star.
Yes.
Star that. We'll get to that. We'll get to that in a bit. So it's an interesting pick, and I'm trying to sort of focus on interesting picks and stuff we haven't covered on the show so far. And one of these shows is one of the ones I picked for my best shows of the year. This is a romantic comedy, which is hiding in obscurity on Paramount Plus, called Colin from Accounts. Now, I don't know, has anybody had a chance to see Colin from Accounts? Matthew, you can chime in as well if you've checked it out. Anybody?
I am embarrassed that it's not on my honorable mentions list because I was waiting for the second season and loved it. Yeah, I love that show.
Okay. Yeah, have you seen the second season then?
Yes.
Yeah. I just, you know, I was on a plane flight earlier like last month, and they had the first three episodes of Colin from Accounts, which I would think actually are in some ways the funniest of the three episodes from the first season. And I was just howling in laughter on the airplane, which is not what you want. When someone is sitting next to you on the airplane. I wasn't howling laughter every minute, but there are some really great gags. Each episode features like at least one incredibly like sharp gag. I just felt like the comedy writing on Colin from Accounts is so good. You know, it's a romantic comedy essentially. Like it's an Australian show, and it is stars is a real life married couple, Patrick Bramall and Harriet Dyer. He's a bit older than she is. He's a lot older than she is in the show. In real life, they're about 6 years difference. And the premise of the show is that he's driving to work and she's like a sixth-year medical student with, I guess, some sort of vague drinking problem. And she flashes her boob at him while he's driving and he gets distracted and he hits a dog. And the dog does not die, but is seriously injured. And the dog has escaped from his house, so it's basically a stray. And they have to basically like take care of this wounded dog together. And it kind of brings them together. And it's a great starting premise for a show, but just the intimacy of the relationship, because they're married and they're also excellent actors and good comic writers, it feels very real for anybody who's been in a relationship like this. And they're also both incredibly cute. You know, you can have it easy for people of any hetero or other persuasion to have crushes on both of them, because they're incredibly cute and their supporting cast is great. And it's really good. It's really moving. And Omar, you have seen it.
Yeah, that should have been on my list. And I just forgot that I saw it because it went by so fast. I mean, I watched it like in one day when the new season dropped. So that's probably why it fell out of my mind. But yeah.
You watched season two in one day. Well, it is quite addictive, right? The episodes are short.
It's like six episodes a season, right? It's very short. Yeah,
I think it's eight, but they're short. They're short and they're funny and they're light and it's really involving. You know, I think it's just it's really a great sitcom and it's you know, quite possibly my favorite sitcom in a long time. So I could not recommend it more highly. So it is time for us to get negative, if that's okay. Matthew, you're up to bat.
Hi.
Hi. I loved your worst TV of shows of the year. As you were saying before we started recording, you don't watch a lot of bad TV. You watch like sort of premium quality TV for the most part. You're sort of an old school HBO viewer in a lot of ways. But
right.
What I liked about your list is that you picked apart shows that some people thought were good, and you pointed out what was so bad about them. And I wanted to mention, I'll run down your list, and then we'll talk about some specifically. We've got Netflix's The Perfect Couple, Nobody Wants This, which was the hot rabbi comedy, which we've talked about on this show before. You talked about some procedurals, Matlock, High Potential, and Elspeth, and I want to talk about those with you. Season three of Hacks, and also Mindy Kaling's The Sex Lives of College Girls. And these are not the shows you usually see on your worst of list. So let's talk about The Perfect Couple. What exactly is so bad about this show? It stars Nicole Kidman.
So I remember a time, you know, in the 1980s when families like the Kennedys, for instance, would be sort of revered. And it wasn't just that they were rich. It was also this idea that, like, they were a good family. And it was shocking that, you know, Chappaquiddick happened. It was shocking that, you know, that that guy Smith was a rapist. Nowadays, we don't really look at families like that and think, oh, these people are lovely. And the whole, I think the whole idea behind the perfect couple is that because this family is very wealthy, everyone is shocked that there's a murder on the premises. And I took one look at this family and thought, yeah, there would be a murder on that premise.
Right.
The premises. I mean, like, and, you know, even just this twist that, oh my God, you know, Nicole Kidman used to be a prostitute. Imagine. And in fact, her job, you know, her character's job in the show is that she's a mystery novelist.
As you point out, that's not necessarily the profession of a high Brahmin.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's sort of this, you know, dissonance between, you know, the twist is that, oh my God, things are not what they seem. And I don't think that anyone reading Vanity Fair nowadays, watching television, watching Real Housewives, et cetera, thought that this would be, you know, that unmentionable or astonishing.
Right. And there are two details that you pointed out that I thought were really funny. One, that you talk about how in the Perfect Couple universe, People Magazine is a culturally significant publication.
Yeah, the People Magazine, the reason that the show is called The Perfect Couple is because, you know, the patriarch and the matriarch, Nicole Kidman and Liev Schreiber, are considered the perfect couple by People Magazine. And number one, they're, you know, it's a novelist and some rich guy. I don't think that anyone, you know, People Magazine wouldn't be really talking about them. And number two, who reads People Magazine anymore? The whole thing just had this very weird, dated quality to it that I really couldn't quite get into.
And you also pointed out that Eve Hewson, who is Bono's real life daughter.
Bono's daughter is, in fact, probably the, you know, the one with the most moneyed background. And she's kind of the girl from the wrong side of the tracks who's marrying into the family, much to everyone's chagrin. It just
doesn't work.
Really,
it doesn't work. Yeah. It's not, it's, you know, because, you know, back in the day, if there was a poor girl from the wrong side of the track, she was played by someone like, you know, Juliette Lewis.
So, I mean, she was lovely, but a little gritty. Yeah.
Someone who you could believe actually came from a working class background.
Right. I mean, shows like Succession have really raised the bar in terms of what we think of, in terms of the nuances of what kind of rich families there are. This rich family didn't seem to really be based on anything. It was just like they had money, therefore they were bad, or right. Therefore this was all very scandalous. And it wasn't really picking apart where the money came from, what the money did. Everyone was kind of snobby, and there was, you know, the cover up of the crime and so forth, but then the crime got solved. It just didn't really have anything to say about wealth other than the fact that, you know, having Nicole Kidman in a show like that and having great wealth automatically gives everyone this sort of like, yeah, let's look at this, you know.
I think there should be a show starring Nicole Kidman and Giancarlo Esposito. It would close the premium streaming circle because there's not
there a stream. Probably is. Nicole Kidman is in everything right now. Yeah, it's crazy. I cannot turn on the TV without seeing her.
However, what she's not on is network TV. And you pointed out, I love that you pointed this trend out because I thought about this myself. This sort of return of the quirky crime and legal procedural. And you pointed out three of them with female protagonists. You got Kathy Bates as Matlock. You have High Potential, which stars Caitlin Olson from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia as a cleaning lady with a brilliant mind. And then Elspeth, which is a third generation spinoff of The Good Wife. And you pointed out that there was a lot of Elsbeth, I think it's called. But you point out there's a lot of similarities among these shows.
Yeah, and the thing is that I think what we're seeing now is the death of like, you know, the golden age of television, in a sense that a lot of shows had a lot of high quality over the last few years in an effort to enlist people to subscribe to certain streaming services. And now what we're seeing is people trying to cash in and streamline certain things. And when you look at a show like The Good Wife or The Good Fight, and then you look at a show like Elsbeth, and Elsbeth is a character from those two series, it's like the quality has gone way downhill. It's like they just got rid of the writing room and the whole thing is just kind of a bunch of hacks, like spitting out procedurals.
Well, yeah, I watched that. I watched some of that High Potential because my son is an It's Always Sunny fan, and so he's like, "Well, Caitlin Olsen's in it. How bad can it be?" And watching that, it just felt like it was written by AI. Like it was so bad.
Yeah, and then. But there are these, you know, like Kathy Bates being in Matlock, you sort of think, oh, this must be a quality show if Kathy Bates is in it. You know, there are certain indicators that make you think that this would be some sort of premium television, but it's actually a beyond, you know, a couple of like nice details. It really, there isn't really much there.
Speaking of hacks, you mentioned the word hacks. Let's talk about Hacks. Season 3. Yeah. Omar, are you a Hacks fan? Yeah, I know you're a comedy guy, so.
I am, and I'm triggered by saying it's a bad show, because I love that show.
All right, well, because you had a point to make, Matthew, about Season 3, which was the sort of the wokeification of Deborah Vance, which I thought was an interesting point.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to, number one, I mean, obviously the show is tailored on the career of Joan Rivers. And the thing about Joan Rivers was that she, because, you know, Deborah Vance is losing relevance, they sort of against her will, they pair her with this younger writer. And the younger writer like encourages her to liven up her material. And in fact, Joan Rivers herself spent her entire career working with younger writers, freshening her material, you know, vigilantly keeping current, which is why she was such a legend and why she stayed on top for so long. I mean, the average shelf life for a comedian is actually very short. And what Joan Rivers did was really incredible. And there are reasons that she was around for so long as she was and had so many ups and downs. And so they kind of take this character of Deborah Vance and they kind of argue that, oh, she's saved your career by sitting with a bunch of college students and allowing them to interrogate her and talk about how triggered they were by her early comedy. And as a result of, you know, listening and changing with the times, she actually manages to save her career and even, you know, thrive. And that's not really how comedy works. Even so-called canceled comedians like Louis C.K. or Dave Chappelle or, you know, all these people, they're doing fine. They're making plenty of money. And this idea that somehow, you know, Deborah Vance was going to lose her career if, you know, any scandal touched her, or if there was anything, like if anything embarrassing videos came up on YouTube, that like that would be the death knell. And it's there's something very like, you know, and in fact, I mean, Joan Rivers died, but if she had been alive, I mean, she was actually friends with Trump. She was a Republican. She had some idea, you know, she was a fierce Zionist. I think she would probably be a very, very polarizing figure at the moment and probably wouldn't apologize for any of it.
Very interesting.
And so this account, you know, this, you know, loosely based on her life thing just couldn't be less authentic.
All right. So there you go. A counterpoint on Hacks. I wanted to talk about Baby Reindeer, which was on Omar's list. Matthew, you also mentioned that.
And almost on my list.
Almost on your list. So, you know, some people, Omar, some people love Baby Reindeer. Why did you put it at the bottom?
I was surprised by the critical reception to it because I thought it was absolute garbage. I mean, I thought it was manipulative. I thought it was very, you know, given the details that we heard after the fact, I thought it was very inauthentic. It was very self-aggrandizing, and even as it was trying to show how pathetic this person, you know, is, the main character, who is also the showrunner and creator, I found it icky and distasteful, and I watched it all the way through because I just had to see how, you know, how it ends. You know, I had to see, okay, where is this going? What is the point here? And by the end of it, I was just kind of disgusted. I just really wish I hadn't watched it by the end of it.
Matthew, you feel the same way?
I just really didn't understand what was so stalkable about the main character. When you're watching Fatal Attraction, there is something, I mean, you know, Michael Douglas is a flawed character, but he is magnetic and you do sort of see why, you know, why he's being stalked. But with this guy, you're like, what? I don't even know what I'm watching here.
All right. So I'm going to pivot now to my list. The rest of Omar's list, we've talked about a lot of these things on the show before. Time Bandits, which was a huge bust. House of the Dragon, he put House of the Dragon on there. And I agree that season two wasn't as good, but I don't know if it was certainly not.
My list was largely shows that should have been better or that I was just disappointed with it. They're not the worst shows on TV because I don't watch the worst shows on TV.
I sometimes do. I sometimes do watch what I consider the worst shows on TV. My list was, and again, I think Scott and I talked about The Acolyte earlier, so we don't have to revisit that, although we talked about it early in the season, Scott.
Right, yeah.
Boy, did that thing fall apart.
Yeah, it wasn't the best Star Wars, but I still enjoyed it because it was Star Wars, mm-hmm. but it really does seem that, you know, in the great Disney Star Wars content push, that they're sacrificing quality for quantity at this point.
If it had been the first Star Wars, there would never have been any more Star Wars. even though there was a Jedi Wookiee with a ponytail. They're totally wasted character, very unamusing. So The Acolyte was bad. Matthew, you and I have talked in the past about Feud, Capote versus the Swans.
Yeah.
I really felt like that was a big misfire. And it didn't get any better as it proceeded.
Yeah, it should have been half as many episodes as it was. It seemed to really just belabor some sort of point,
or just a movie. I mean, it's 8 hours
really,
of that
it wasn't
shit.
Really a feud. It was these women kind of kicked him to the curb, and that was that. It wasn't like, you know, two people going at each other, much to everyone's delight or disgust.
Yeah, it wasn't as much of a feud as it should have been. And that episode, the fake documentary episode, it was distasteful, and also it was just a waste of the black and white ball, which was one of the sort of great social events of the 20th century, and we could have been that could have been much more fun than it was. Scott, did we talk about the Lord of the Rings, the Rings of Power? Did I talk about that with someone else on the show? I'm trying to remember.
We have not talked about that, but I am finally making my way through season two.
Why are you doing that to yourself? It's so boring. It's so boring
because it's Lord of the Rings.
But it's not. It's not. It's kind of like there's just more of this not explaining who this guy really is.
Yeah, you know, the fact that I've been kind of sitting on it for so long and I've watched like two episodes and I'm not like really jazzed about getting back into it, I think that says a lot because I should, of all people, be really, really excited about a Lord of the Rings related
show.
And,
sure, of course.
I wasn't like fully feeling it. You're right.
Yeah. You know, compare that to like Dune Prophecy, which I find, you know, it's a little nappy for me. Like I find I'm generally kind of a sleep during some boring parts of Dune kind of guy, but I recognize that it's quality television. You know, it's very different than the Lord of the Rings. I mean, who is writing this stuff? It is bad. And I picked a couple of shows on my list that, well, one, I hate Food. Does anyone else watch the Food Network here? Anyone? No. I picked a show called Last Bite Hotel, which stars Titus Burgess from The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. And he plays himself, but in the show, he's the owner of a semi-creepy haunted hotel that for some reason is hosting a cooking competition. And the people who are cooking on the competition are people who have cooked on a bunch of other Food Network shows. And they bring like a suitcase or a trunk, and they only get to cook with a certain number of ingredients for the entire season. And then other Food Network personalities stop in to judge them. It's kind of like the Traitors. Anyone watch The Traitors on Peacock? Right. The Alan Cumming show, but mixed with Chopped. And I just want to learn how to cook. Titus Burgess is funny, but I mean, what are we doing here? The Food Network's really hit the bottom of the barrel with that. But the last thing I want to discuss, does anyone else here, has anyone else watched the new Nkuti Gatwa Doctor Who?
Nope.
Nobody. Has anyone ever watched a single episode of Doctor Who?
I love Doctor Who, but I fell off in the last couple of seasons, I got to admit.
Well, this thing, well, first of all, for the new season, right, they brought David Tennant back for two or three episodes, which was kind of fun, sort of reminiscent of that revival that was good. But then he goes away and the Gatwa episodes start. And two of the first three numbers feature big, elaborate musical numbers. It turns into a musical. And then there's this horrible episode in between where they go into space and they meet a bunch of talking babies. It was like, Look Who's Talking, but on a spaceship. I mean, it was bad. And then his companion, I couldn't watch to the end of the season. My son watched. His companion is this woman who was born on Christmas, and the whole mystery of the season is who her mother was. And it turns out that her mother was just an ordinary woman, and the special power that this companion has was that she was the living spirit of Christmas. The living spirit of Christmas was traveling with Doctor Who throughout time and space. You can't get any worse than that as far as TV goes. It is the very bottom. I consider the new season of Doctor Who to be the absolute bottom of the TV barrel. And it's disappointing for me because, you know, I don't think Doctor Who was ever actually good. Maybe I just thought it was because I was 8 years old. Is that possible? But this is really bad. So I'm not the living spirit of Christmas. I am the living spirit of Hanukkah. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe. And this has been our TV year in review. We've talked about the best and worst TV shows of the year. And I'd like to thank all my guests, all fabulous writers and frequent contributors to the site. I'm so grateful to all of them for continuing to work with me under very austere conditions. Omar Gayaga, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Matthew Ehrlich.
Thanks, Neil.
And thank you to Scott Gold, my sometime substitute host and soldier in the pop culture's war. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you very much, Neil. Always great to be here, man.
Oh, of course. And I hope you guys will continue to watch TV in 2025. I'm guessing you're going to.
No, I'm pivoting to CB radio.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I'm just going retro, man.
Old media. Well, as soon as we get off, I'm going to go watch some more TV. I think I'm just going to stay up all night watching TV. I'm going to pull an all-nighter. So, thank you guys so much. We will talk to you in the new year, if not before. Thank you so much to Omar, to Scott, and to Matthew. Please continue to read Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We will be back next week with our 2024 year in review for movies, and I will talk to you then.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at the Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's the Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.